Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.3, Felicia Tyria, Greek Revolution, Part 1. Last time, we left off as the Serbs finally held off against their Ottoman overlords and then gradually established themselves as an autonomous state. Now, we ended by looking ahead a good bit, because I wanted to give some context for where all of the events of the Serbian Revolution were headed, specifically towards officially recognized independence by 1878. This process of gradual independence took half a century. However, by the end of the Serbian Revolution proper in 1817, Serbia was technically a principality, still under Ottoman suzerainty. Now, just to make sure we're all on the same page here, a suzerainty basically describes a situation where a state is all but autonomous, except when it comes to matters of foreign policy, and except for having to pay an imperial tribute. Suzerainties are very important within the late Ottoman Empire, and as we'll see, many provinces will, like Serbia, go through a period of suzerainty before they actually become fully independent. And this is kind of a natural consequence of the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century becoming increasingly unable to maintain its vast and diverse empire, but still desperately trying to hold on to as much of it as possible, even if many of their nominal domains were only held on by the tiniest of threads. Now, for our next several episodes, we are turning to the Greeks. And what makes the Greek Revolution unique within our story is that they will not come out of their revolution as a mere principality under Ottoman suzerainty, but will instead earn complete independence by the end of their struggle. This will kind of change the game and raise the stakes for all future nationalistic movements within Ottoman domains. Because while the Serbs were the first to take up arms as revolutionary nationalists, the Greeks would be the first to fully break away from the Ottomans, no strings attached. By the end of the Greek Revolution, the First Hellenic Republic and then the Kingdom of Greece will be established as a fully independent nation-state, a fact that marks it as one of the very first modern nation-states to win independence from an old world empire. The emergence of modern nation-states, rising out of the ashes of old world empires, will be one of the defining revolutionary processes to grow out of the chaos of World War I, and the Greeks got this ball rolling nearly 100 years earlier. Within the Ottoman context specifically, the Greeks initiated a process that would eventually end with the birth of modern Turkey itself in 1923. The emergence of the Turkish Republic under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was the last of these struggles to create a national homeland out of the collapsing Ottoman Empire. The Greek Revolution was the first. So, when the Felicia Tyria initiated the Greek Revolution in February of 1821, they were embarking on a somewhat unprecedented venture as they sought to create what would eventually become conceived of as the modern nation-state of Greece, out of a population made up of people who, for the most part, thought of Greeks or Hellenes as a title denoting an ancient peoples, you know, like Socrates, Plato, Odysseus, Achilles. The Greek-speaking Christians within the Ottoman Empire mainly called themselves Romaioi, which literally just means Romans, but in practice meant Orthodox Christians. In fact, many of these Orthodox Christians did not initially accept the Hellenic Greek title, as it referenced a pagan people within a distant and remote past. The project of the Felicia Tyria, and later the Greek Revolution itself, was to create a nation of peoples out of a collection of tribes within the Ottoman Empire who, yes, shared a language and a religion, but did not really think of themselves as Greeks in any way that we might recognize today. This fact points to why the Greek Revolution was so influential and important, because it was one of the earliest struggles for national independence, born out of a desire to create a homeland for an ethnic peoples with a shared national heritage. And because they were some of the very first to embark on such an audacious project, the process would be bumpy, to say the least, with multiple civil wars fought during the War of Independence between several factions, all vying for power within this brand new thing that would eventually become modern Greece. But all the bloody infighting is for later. For now, we turn to a small group of idealistic intellectuals who dreamed of winning freedom for their people. The Philiki Etairia, translated as the Society of Friends, was a secret revolutionary organization founded in 1814 in Odessa, a city in modern-day Ukraine that was at the time part of the Russian Empire. At first, the society was made up mainly of Phanariot Greeks, which, as we learned last episode, broadly describes prominent Greek families who originated in Constantinople, but who had later spread throughout the Ottoman and Russian empires. Early Etairia members were primarily part of this Greek diaspora, and many lived outside of the area of modern-day Greece, a fact that would become pretty important during the later revolutionary infighting, as some of these Etairists would be labeled as foreigners. And as with all upstart secret revolutionary societies, their numbers were at first quite small, initially started by just three dudes with a crazy idea, a student, a merchant, and a hat maker, all of whom had originated in the Greek mainland, but who had, each in their own way, ended up in Odessa. These men came out of the post-Napoleonic world of early 19th century fraternal societies. One had joined the Freemasons, and another had joined a Greek cultural society in Paris. The cosmopolitan and international background of these initial members would stamp the future makeup of the organization. Their experience within other secret societies would be important as well, as from their founding, the Etairia were influenced by clandestine societies of the time, such as the Freemasons and the Italian revolutionary group, the Carbonari. Though the Philiki Etairia were in many ways the most successful of these numerous secret societies that defined this era. Initially, the Etairia was formed in direct response to the European-wide conservative backlash coming out of the Congress of Vienna, which had finally ended a 20-year period of near constant warfare at the hands of revolutionary France and then later Napoleonic France. Due to this recent apocalyptic upheaval that was the Napoleonic Wars, the great powers of Europe were extremely skeptical of anything that might upset the status quo of the post-Napoleonic settlement, and especially of anything that had even the slightest whiff of revolution. The Congress of Vienna had inaugurated an age dominated by the conservative Holy Alliance of Austria, Prussia, and Russia, under the leadership of the infamous Chancellor Clemens von Metternich, a man whose secret police would come to haunt the dreams of revolutionaries everywhere. As part of this conservative anti-revolutionary stance, Metternich refused to address any concerns within the Ottoman Balkans, and he flatly rejected the idea that there could ever even be such a thing as, like, a Greek nation. Because, for Metternich, dreams of national liberation meant revolution, and revolution meant war. Now, when a group of Greeks did plead their case at the Congress of Vienna, the Russian Tsar actually revealed that he was, you know, at least a little sympathetic towards their cause. But he had much bigger concerns, and the Tsar's number one priority, like Metternich, was maintaining the fragile post-Napoleonic peace. After the Congress, it became clear to all Greeks with any dreams of liberation that they were fighting very much alone. So these Greeks resolved to take matters into their own hands. And so was born the Philiki Etairia. Living within this world full of anti-revolutionary forces, the Etairia faced a problem which all secret societies face. They needed to remain hidden while they were at the same time trying to grow their numbers. So the Etairia developed a hierarchical structure in which there were secret signs and semi-mystical initiation ceremonies and a chain of command in which the lower down you went, the less you knew about the actual origins and goals of the society. You know, all the juicy secret society stuff. In this structure, the lowest members simply knew that the society had the goal of, quote, the improvement of the fatherland. The middle tier members above this knew that the society was made up of Greeks who had as a loose goal the eventual liberation of Greece. Yet the method by which liberation would be achieved was kept intentionally vague, though these middle agents could recruit new members into their ranks. The identity of the leadership of the Etairia was a closely held secret, and they were simply referred to as the Supreme Authority. The mystery of who exactly was the Supreme Authority had multiple functions. First, it obviously protected the founding members of the society from possible arrest. Secondly, though, and perhaps even more importantly, by keeping the leadership a secret, those joining the Etairia could all project their own wild, crazy fantasies onto who might be behind the society. This mystique was intentionally fostered by the leadership, and rumors that the Tsar of Russia himself was actually behind the Etairia were not only allowed to spread, but were positively encouraged. The rumors that there was a great power behind the Etairia helped the initial growth of the society enormously, as it gave legitimacy to the organization and offered a general sense of security for recruits who could be comforted by the idea that they were being protected by some greater and more powerful force as they took on the pretty significant risks associated with membership. Another important aspect of the Etairia was Christian orthodoxy, as the society often used the language of religious struggle with the goal of Christianity triumphing over Islam. This influence of orthodoxy set the Etairia apart from other Greek societies throughout Europe, which tended to be more scholarly, based in the Enlightenment fascination with the ancient Greeks, you know, Socrates, Plato, and which typically operated more out in the open. When compared with these learned Greek societies who were pretty moderate, the Etairia was much more radical in their desire for immediate revolutionary war against the Ottomans. The split between these moderate intellectuals based in Enlightenment secularism and the radicals of the Etairia based in religious orthodoxy would come to define later revolutionary infighting during and after the War for Independence. By 1818, the Etairia had become very successful in their ability to recruit members, and the society began bringing in more and more people within the Greek diaspora, mainly around the Black Sea in the southern Russian Empire and in the all-important Danubian principalities of modern Romania. Many of the members brought into the Etairia early on were part of the international business community of Greek-speaking merchants. Due to their connections in the Ottoman Empire and farther west into Europe, many Greeks held important positions within the world of international trade. Because of this, the secret language that the Etairia would use to safely communicate with each other was actually drawn from the world of commerce. Accounts meant armed forces. Balance sheet meant war, and the Russian Tsar was known as the philanthropist. In this way, members used their occupation as merchants as a cover while they made connections and passed information all across Europe. The Etairia also had success recruiting in the heart of the Ottoman Empire, gaining many members in Constantinople itself. As the society grew, many people joined who would go on to become huge names in the future revolutions, such as Theodoros Kolokotronis, Alexandros Mavrokordatos, and Papaflesas, just to name a few. Notably, though, the man often considered as the founder of modern Greece, Ioannis Kapodistrias, refused to join the Etairia when he was approached by them in 1818 and asked to become their leader. Kapodistrias, already an incredibly important European diplomat, who at the time was no less than the foreign minister of Russia, actually denounced the organization early on as essentially pursuing goals that were extremely premature, because he believed a fight for Greek independence was not only bound to fail, but was also potentially deadly. He rightly predicted that the Ottoman backlash against Greek unrest would be incredibly harsh and lead to immense suffering for everyday Greeks within the empire. With the refusal of Kapodistrias to become their leader, the Hetairia instead approached a colorful and aristocratic Napoleonic war veteran named Alexandros Ypsilantis. Ypsilantis was a Phanariot prince and an officer in the Imperial Russian army who had risen to become the aide-de-camp for the Russian Tsar himself. So the approaching of Kapodistrias and the eventual appointment of Ypsilantis reveals just how deeply the Hetairia had penetrated elite Russian society. Ypsilantis came from an extremely illustrious Phanariot Greek family, as his father had been an interpreter for the Sultan, an important position within the Ottoman imperial world, and his father had also served as the governor of the Danubian principalities before being forced to flee to Russia due to his involvement in an early conspiracy to liberate Greece, and then due to his decision to side with Russia in the Russo-Turkish War of 1806 that had been so important for our friends in Serbia. After his father's exile, Ypsilantis had grown up amidst high Russian society, and he eventually became an officer in the Russian army. Ypsilantis fought against the French during Napoleon's failed invasion of Russia, and then during a later battle, Ypsilantis famously had his right arm torn off, which added to his renown for near reckless bravery. Once Napoleon had been finally defeated in 1814, Ypsilantis was important enough that he actually attended the peace talks at the Congress of Vienna that would inaugurate the Holy Alliance and the conservative influence of Chancellor Metternich. At the Congress, both Ypsilantis and his fellow Greek, the Russian foreign minister, Kapodistrias, were part of a faction offering an alternative to Metternich's future for Europe. Metternich sought to completely stamp out the revolutionary fire that had been lit by Napoleon and that had then spread across Europe during his conquests. Kapodistrias and others who followed his lead, like Ypsilantis, argued for the need to at least understand these revolutionary forces, because these forces had inspired dreams of national liberation from old despotic empires, and these dreams could not simply be ignored. As Kapodistrias very presciently said during the conference, quote, "This war has not been fought by sovereigns, but by nations." Kapodistrias and Ypsilantis were not successful in turning the future of Europe in a more moderate direction, because Metternich's vision of absolute repression ultimately won out. They had, however, won the sympathy of the Russian Tsar, and Ypsilantis was thereafter appointed as the Tsar's aide-de-camp. And so it was that Ypsilantis, now a top officer in the Imperial Russian Army, would accept the invitation to become the leader of the Filiki Hetairia in April 1820. As a Russian officer, the appointment of Ypsilantis greatly enhanced the legitimacy of the Hetairia and would further fuel rumors that the Tsar was actually behind the whole operation. However, as we have seen, these rumors were a complete fantasy. Now, it was true that the Tsar sympathized with the Greeks as fellow Orthodox Christians, but his first priority was keeping the peace at all costs, and even the champion of the Greeks, Kapodistrias, had apparently tried to dissuade Ypsilantis from taking on the leadership of the Hetairia, once again making his case that the time was just not right for such revolutionary fancies. The goal of the Hetairia had always been to establish a Greek state independent of the Ottomans by way of a revolution. However, with the election of Ypsilantis, things began to move quite fast. Within a month of taking the helm, Ypsilantis, who would prove himself to be a bit of a loose cannon, had begun actively planning for how to begin a war against the Ottomans. partly due to the fact that the Ottoman authorities were becoming increasingly aware of the Etairia's activities and that a crackdown was probably imminent. Ypsilantis decided to go ahead and push forward with a revolt in February of 1821. The initial plan had been to launch the attacks in the Peloponnese, the peninsula of modern-day Greece, and Ypsilantis even sent some emissaries to begin preparations on the peninsula. Because the Peloponnese was deep in the heart of Ottoman territory, though, Ypsilantis changed his plans and decided to begin the revolt in his place of birth within the Danubian principalities of modern Romania. As we have seen, the Danubian principalities were one of those weird areas in the Balkans that were semi-autonomous Ottoman provinces that were yet under dual influence of the Ottomans and the Russians. And so the area therefore came to be seen as an ideal place to launch the revolution. The Ypsilantis name was also well known in the region due to his father being a former governor there. However, this notoriety was not completely positive, as the local peasants, who were primarily Romanian, not Greek, saw their Phanariot Greek overlords as corrupt foreigners. Even so, leading up to his invasion of the territory, Ypsilantis was able to drum up some local support for his cause, though this was in many ways due to the fact that Ypsilantis was always subtly implying that they had the support of the Tsar, and that the weight of the Russian imperial army was going to be the decisive factor that would tip the scales in favor of Greek independence. During this initial phase, Russian support for the Greek cause would become an almost comically common refrain within the revolutionary proclamations of Ypsilantis and other Etairia leaders, even though they in no way had any guarantee of Russian intervention from the Tsar. Nevertheless, Ypsilantis and the Etairia would always hint that the Russians are, you know, just right behind us, and this rumor of Russian support was a big reason that many people joined the initial revolt at all. As the Etairia gained momentum in the area, they eventually garnered the support of the local governor. However, due to these successful recruiting efforts, the Etairia had now lost all pretense of secrecy, and their plan was common knowledge by the time of the invasion. And so, on February 21st, 1821, Ypsilantis famously crossed the Prut River and attacked the small town of Galati, burning down an Ottoman outpost and then subsequently massacring the few Muslims who resided in the town. These violent actions taken against the local Muslims may have been a deliberate effort to provoke an Ottoman reprisal against Christians that would lead to a Russian response in support of the revolutionaries. Ypsilantis continued moving into Ottoman territory, gaining troops as he went, so that within a week the army numbered nearly 7,000 strong. This army was quite a ragtag collection, however, being made up of mercenaries and bands led by local chieftains, and they hailed from all over the Balkans, with only about a third actually being Greek. As they marched towards Bucharest, today's capital of Romania, the army quickly transformed into a disorganized band of brigands who did nothing to ingratiate themselves to the local Romanians, as they primarily went around looting and drinking. As they marched along, Ypsilantis became increasingly despondent at the behavior of his army and their inability to inspire local support for their cause. Then, the true hammer came down when it was learned that the Holy Alliance of Russia, Prussia, and Austria had just announced a joint resolution to oppose all revolutionary activity that threatened the peace of Europe. The only reason Ypsilantis had been able to recruit, like anyone at all, was that a Russian invasion to support them was supposed to be imminently out on the horizon. In a panic, Ypsilantis actually wrote a letter to the Tsar himself, whom he knew personally, but the Tsar reprimanded him, understandably furious that an officer in his army had compromised their fragile alliances with the other great powers. Even though defeat was now all but certain, Ypsilantis and his army, the so-called Sacred Band, managed to hold out for several months. The Sacred Band had Bucharest as their goal. However, simultaneous with the revolt of Ypsilantis, another uprising had actually begun in February of 1821, which led to proto-Romanian nationalists taking control of Bucharest. Ironically, this revolt was aimed against Phanariot Greek rule in the region, who were the very Greek elites from which many of the Etairia members, such as Ypsilantis, had originated. Nevertheless, these proto-Romanian nationalists and Ypsilantis' sacred band formed an uneasy alliance and together actually managed to take control of Bucharest in March 1821. This alliance did not last, however, once the leaders of the Romanian camp learned that Ypsilantis' claim that he had the support of the Tsar was completely false. Upon learning of this deception, a few of the leaders of the Romanians secretly negotiated with the Ottomans and withdrew from the city. The Sultan's army then invaded the area in April, and even though the Sacred Band would put up a courageous fight, with the departure of Romanian support, they never really had a chance, and they were soundly defeated by June 1821. In the end, Kapodistrias, the foreign minister of Russia who had warned Ypsilantis of the folly of his plans, had been right. Ypsilantis' harebrained adventure in the Danubian Principality was doomed to fail from the beginning, as they were facing off against an ancient and powerful empire without any outside support, though they had hoped to the bitter end that the Tsar would come to rescue them. Kapodistrias also predicted the outcome of such an adventure, as the immediate result of Ypsilantis' revolt was harsh Ottoman repression taken against Orthodox Christians within the Ottoman Empire. The most dramatic instance of this repression was the Constantinople Massacre of 1821, in which Orthodox Christians were targeted in officially sanctioned pogroms, as Greek property was looted, churches were destroyed, and hundreds of Greeks were killed en masse. All of this ethno-religious violence culminated in the hanging of the Ecumenical Patriarch, the recognized head of the Eastern Orthodox Church. This mass violence against Greek Orthodox Christians would ultimately backfire for the Ottomans, as it led European public opinion to begin to sympathize with the Greeks, a factor that would become decisive later on in the Greek struggle. But that is for later. Alexandros Ypsilantis, for his part, did not welcome his defeat with much grace. In a final declaration to his soldiers, Ypsilantis refused to take any blame at all for the disastrous defeat and accused his soldiers of cowardice. After giving this absolutely stirring speech, Ypsilantis was actually booed by his army. So, in order to prevent his troops from surrendering, Ypsilantis went on to straight up lie to his soldiers, telling them that Austria had declared war on the Ottomans. He then acted like he was going to Austria to negotiate with their military leaders, being like, "Yeah guys, I'll be right back, just going to talk to my powerful friends over in Austria. They'll help us, I know it." He then proceeded to cross into Austria, with the hope of gaining asylum, and without any intention of returning to his abandoned army. Due to the reactionary politics of Metternich and company, however, Ypsilantis was kept under close confinement for most of his remaining life, eventually dying in poverty in early 1828. The efforts of Ypsilantis and the Etairia would not be fought in vain, however, and Ypsilantis is remembered as a hero in the mythology of the Greek Revolution, not, as you might expect, as a bumbling failure. This legacy is due to the fact that at nearly the same time that Ypsilantis was leading the Sacred Band in their doomed revolt in the Danubian Principalities, other Greek revolutionaries were fighting a much more successful campaign against the Ottomans farther south in the Peloponnese and in western Greece. As it turned out, the emissaries that Ypsilantis had sent to the Peloponnese to begin preparations for his arrival had had remarkable success in their recruitment efforts. Ypsilantis also forgot to send word that the plan had actually changed and that the revolt was being launched further north. So, as Ypsilantis was epically failing in the Danubian Principalities, these Etairia agents were quickly growing their numbers because, following the example of their leaders, they were telling everyone that would listen that Russia would eventually come to help them. And these revolts down in the Peloponnese would turn out to be much more successful than Ypsilanti's voyage of the damned. And so it would be that the Peloponnesians would be the ones to truly make 1821 the beginning of Greek independence.